upon their arrival was almost unspeakable.
We brought all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Hello, and welcome to the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. I'm Vicky.
And I'm Janelle.
We're back again with another show for you. Yay. This one...
Slightly subdued, yay.
I feel like every time we record, it's getting earlier and earlier in the morning. And I am not a morning person, like at all.
I'm a morning person, but I'm a, I don't really sleep very much when it's hot person. So.
Oh my God, yeah. I discovered the other day that, like yesterday, I looked at the thermostat in our house and my father had secretly upped it to 70, set it at 75. I was like,
ew.
What?
No, that is what? Too high.
I know.
That's a sauna practically.
In that. I'm looking into, they make like, not like the full units, but they're like little personal units that I kind of want to get for myself to keep in here.
And I've said this before, we live in a 100-year-old house and putting central air in here would be insane because it would be $1 million. So we have one unit. And we don't have anything upstairs, so we definitely are looking at something because global warming called, and they want your soul. It's too fucking hot.
It's way too fucking hot. I'm sure you guys do not want to hear us bitch about
this. Is old
heat.
Lady corner.
This
is Bad Taste Crime Cast.
So we won't. We're just gonna head over to the newsroom. Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. Okay, so this week, our news comes from NPR, because guess what they found in Canada?
Ugh.
More unmarked
graves.
I know. We talked about this 2 episodes ago, and since recording, it was probably like, I think a week after the episode we last talked about this on came out, they were like, guess what? Found more. I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Although also not really surprised with,
I'm not
like,
surprised
given the history of.
I've talked to, like, in through school, I've talked to survivors of residential schools. I'm 1,000% not surprised.
No. And I do feel like, again, it's something that we need to highlight, we need to talk about, because somebody's got some dues coming for all this bullshit.
Well, I hope.
you would like to think so, right?
I mean, they've been doing it for hundreds of years. What's going to change now?
So, if you have no idea what we are talking about, on June
First
24th...
of all, how dare you?
On June 24th, it was announced that more bodies had been found at the Maryvale Indian Residential School, which was an operation from 1899 to 1997, which is not that long ago.
Yeah. Although the last year they were considered like a Catholic school or whatever. Still doesn't matter.
Yeah. So currently it's the location of the Cowessess First Nation. They also went in here with ground penetrating radar showing 751 hits, and officials believe that there are at least 600 bodies buried at this site, because there is like a margin of error for the ground penetrating radar. So interestingly enough, Chief Cadmus Delorme of the Cowessess said that there were grave markers there at one point in time, but the Roman Catholic Church, who operated the school, had them removed.
Yep. But there's not that many grave markers.
No. That is actually an anomaly that they would have marked them at all.
Yeah.
The day after the discoveries, Pope Francis did express pain and sympathy about the discovery, but offered no apology on behalf of the Catholic Church, because let's remember, that was the point of all of these residential schools. So at this point, now two huge discoveries, because the last one was something like 200, I think, bodies.
Yeah.
This is obviously three times that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not great. I would expect there to be a push now to further investigate more and more former sites of these residential schools, like even more than there was before.
Well, I don't know if you saw this bit of news, but the Secretary of the Interior, Debbie Holland, started an investigation for residential schools in the United States.
I did not see that.
So she announced publicly that they will be investigating all of the schools in the United States. And there were quite a bit. There's a list that I posted.
Oh, wait.
You said the United States? Yeah, in the United States. There's 365 schools. Because of what happened in Canada, they took the initiative. And they said that they will be investigating all 365 former residential schools in the United States.
Well, I think that's great. Honestly, I find it a little unfortunate that sometimes it takes like something happening somewhere else to be like, maybe we should look at our own shit and figure out what happened. Because let's be real, and this is something we've talked about before, the United States was like a test case for a lot of these things that other countries picked up, things like residential schools. Things like concentration camps.
I mean, the residential schools are concentration camps.
Yeah.
Let's not sugarcoat it.
Like, we are not innocent of doing the exact same thing here. So I think it's great that they're going to look into it here as well. I just hope that the investigation is done in earnest and it's not just like we're doing this show to look.
Performative. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So hopefully I don't have to share any more news like that. But honestly, I feel like if there is more things uncovered, I think we're going to talk about it on the show. Because I know this is something that both you and I are very passionate about. So
yes. And it's a little bit related to what I'll be covering today as well.
Oh. Oh, so. Yes. Oh, I didn't even think about that. I forgot about that. So that being said, we got to do Netflix and Kill first.
Okay. Don't forget.
Oh, yeah. So we are going to be looking a little forward. I'm trying to think when this it'll be just after this episode comes out, I believe, July 14th. Netflix is releasing a new documentary called Private Network, Who Killed Manuel Buendia?
I haven't seen a thing for this yet.
I saw the trailer for it and read into the case a little bit, and I was like, holy shit, Janelle is going to love this. Or at least the concept and the case behind it. So Buendia was a Mexican journalist who worked at the most read paper in Mexico City, the Daily Excelsior. His column, called Red Privada or Private Network, looked into government and law enforcement corruption, organized crime, and drug trafficking.
Ooh.
He is most well known for his reporting, which includes his coverage of CIA covert operations in Mexico, the rise of ultra-right-wing groups, fraudulent businessmen, corruption in Mexico's state-owned petroleum company, Pemex, and the role of organized crime in Mexico's political system. So I think you can see where this is going.
Yeah, anyone who talks about corruption in Mexico gets murdered. Yeah. So
on May 30th, 1984, Buendia was shot from behind several times as he was walking from his office to his car, leaving him dead at the scene. The investigation into his death lasted 5 years, and in the end, several members of the now disbanded Federal Security Directorate, which was at the time Mexico's top police force. I get the impression that it was kind of like KGB-ish, like kind of Kremlin-y, you know? So a couple of members of, they call it the DSR? I forget.
Letters.
Were arrested. Yes. For their involvement. However, there's a ton of doubt that's been cast over this investigation, and a lot of people still believe that the real killers were never arrested. But I totally get this kind of like conspiracy vibe with all of his governmental investigation. Quite frankly, there's a lot of corruption in Mexico's government.
Yeah.
That puts Chicago to shame, I would say.
It really does. Yeah.
So I think this is going to be a really interesting watch. It is all in Spanish. So heads up on that because you're going to need subtitles. Don't watch this like before bed or like. But it looks really, really interesting. And that comes out on July 14th. This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. This week, we are talking about a lot of stuff. Holy moly.
Yes. If you're Indigenous, it will be completely triggering and traumatizing. So
yes.
Maybe not listen.
I will also say this is probably going to be one of our more political episodes. We don't have very many, but definitely leans that way.
Yes.
There are going to be instances of murder and killing, and we're probably going to talk about some really sensitive topics. So heads up on all that, because this week we are talking about standoffs. So I was inspired by this old, I am on video with Janelle. She can kind of see it's like an old Northwest Herald.
When is that from?
So this
the
one.
Logo. Choice.
Yes, that was the first thing I noticed. This is from January 19th, 1988.
Yeah.
There's literally the top article is about a district talking about AIDS policy and how to do AIDS education. So, like, if that gives you any idea.
Whoa, that is, progressive, Harold.
Yeah. And there was some political thing in here that I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Oh, it was the end of the Ronald Reagan era. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing this up is because we found this in my basement this weekend as some cleaning was being done. And on the front page, there's this little down in the corner right here. It's just like a little thing that says Utah standoff passes its third day. And I was like, what is this about? Because Utah, think about it for a second.
Yes.
Lots of standoffs happen out there, yeah. And lots of Mormons. So I looked into it and found out that this is actually a story that spans many years and includes multiple standoffs.
Jeez Louise, okay.
Yeah, it was like, and I love finding stories like this where it's like one little thing and I look into it and it's like this onion of layers and layers to the story. Mm-hmm. So
you've been in a really... You've been in a real Mormon hole lately, Vicky.
Yeah, you know. I go through cycles of like looking into religion and then doing more like murdery things and then doing like, I was just on a kick of white collar crimes and like fraud and like that kind of stuff. It's just, yeah, goes in cycles. Right now, it's religion.
Yes.
So this is a story of the Singer Swap standoff. And like I said, it's quite an expansive tale that really has echoes of Ruby Ridge and Waco, both of which would happen later. This actually happened way before Ruby Ridge and Waco. So I wouldn't be surprised if the people involved there also knew about this.
Yeah. And mine was a little bit before yours. So
yeah. Yeah. So... it all starts out with a man named John Singer, which is a name that is infamous among fundamentalist Mormons in Utah. John was born in 1932 in New York City, but spent the first chunk of his youth in Germany, where he was a member of the Hitler Youth.
Well, we're off to a really great start.
I know. It's just, you know, it's cool. Pretty major. And he was involved with the Hitler Youth, I believe, until he was about 15. So.
Okay. So well past the age of not knowing what's going on or having opinions. So cool.
Yup. So later in life, he returned to the States and John joined the Mormon Church and was a member for many, many years before being excommunicated in 1973 for, quote, constantly questioning Mormon doctrine. And from what I could tell, one of the major reasons was he was a very big advocate of polygamy, which within the LDS is kind of like a splitting point at some places.
Who isn't, you know?
Who doesn't want like 7 wives?
Why would you want so many wives?
Yeah. Yeah. And polygamy is one of these things that I'm like, it is totally one of these things that I'm just like, you do you for the most part. There is some places where there's this like abusive aspect to it, which is not cool. But at the same time.
Did you ever watch Big Love, Vicky?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I think of all the time. Yeah. Like, if you're going to do polygamy, do it Bill Paxton style.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there are some people who, it does not have that abusive aspect to it, and who are into it. And that's cool. That's fine. As long as it's not abusive. But like, at the same time, I also wonder about, I realize it's just a biblical thing, but why can't we have multiple husbands? That's what I want to know.
Do you really want multiple husbands?
No, but I wish it would be done from some pioneering, like, woman, you know, wanting to do polygamy the other way. I don't know.
There are some Southeast Asian communities, more indigenous, where it's more of a matriarchal society. And I think it was the Philippines, or there's another island over there, where they do have a society like that, where a woman has her home. And she has multiple husbands who live in their own homes.
Oh, nice. I like that.
Yeah, she invites, you know, whatever husband over she wants for whatever time period. So I think it's because, you know, Western civilization is more of a patriarchal society. But there's arguments. Mostly indigenous communities are matriarchal, so.
Yeah.
I'm down with that. You know?
Yeah. So there's this great Washington Post article by John Harrington about John Singer's background, where they talk about his marriage to his first wife in 1963, Vicki Lemon. So this is from that article, quote, "Her parents caused a furor, saying that Singer had brainwashed their daughter. They even tried to get her committed to a mental hospital. The Singers fled to Nevada to have the ceremony performed, and they returned to Singer's Marion, Utah farm and prepared for what Singer said would be a time only the fittest will survive," end quote.
That doesn't sound too appealing.
That's already a little doomsday-ish. Mm-hmm. So following his excommunication in 1973, John decided to pull 5 of his school-aged kids out of school to homeschool them because he objected to much of the public school teaching, specifically the subject of racial equality.
Yeah, that's surprising he put them in there in the first place.
Yeah, well, and sometimes it's easier to do that and comply with the state Board of Education requirements. Mm-hmm. But not this time, because, like, initially, the school board was totally fine with him pulling his kids out, but he decided to ignore all of the school board progress testing, which resulted in the Summit County attorney filing a criminal misdemeanor charge.
Yeah. There's still standards that you have to adhere by. I deal a lot with homeschool students in the past couple jobs I've had teaching art classes for homeschool students, and a lot of the people I've encountered have left the public school sphere because they want it to be a extremely religious-based educational experience. So much so that they're teaching, they'll teach the requirements of the state, and then after that, teach why that is incorrect. So like dinosaurs existing, and why that's not correct and doesn't align with the Bible. So stuff like that. Oh, it's real fun to talk to those children because it blows my mind.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And I think there is sort of this misconception about homeschooling where it's like, well, I can pull my kid out and teach them whatever I want. And not realizing you still have like state requirements you have to deal with.
And Illinois and California, I think, have the strictest homeschool requirements from the state. So. Mm-hmm.
Which I would say is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, the story of John Singer standing up to the state sort of spread far and wide, which attracted reporters and supporters alike to their ranch. Many of the supporters showed up saying that they had been sent by God to support their mission.
Okay.
Summit County Sheriff Ron Robinson took notice as well, who was at this point like, wrestling with a way to bring John Singer into court. He had attempted on several occasions to approach John non-violently and ask him to voluntarily give himself up. But each time John insisted that if it came down to it, he would defend himself and his family with firearms if he had to.
The only way to do it.
Yep. You're on my land. Let me get my guns.
You're talking to my family? Guns.
Don't talk to me or my son ever again. Now, during the conflict with the state, John Singer expanded his family by taking a second wife named Shirley Black, because polygamy.
Wait, so what was the last name of his first wife? Was Lemon?
Vicky Lemon.
Lemon and
Black. But now
Black.
It's Vicky Singer. Yeah.
Very interesting last names.
Yeah. So she brought with her 5 kids from a previous marriage.
Oh, that's interesting.
So 10 kids altogether. Things finally came to a head when a raid was conducted on the Singer's home in October 19th, 1978. Again, from the Washington Post article, quote, "That day, as dusk approached, a black Lincoln Continental drove up the turnout to the Singer property. A man identifying himself as Bob Wilson of the Los Angeles Times climbed out. He was, in reality, an officer of the Utah Highway Patrol with a warrant for Singer's arrest. He told Singer he had a crew in a van following close behind. When the crew arrived, they trapped Singer and forced him into the van as Singer's 2 wives and 10 children swarmed the lawmen. Singer freed a hand and pulled a .38 caliber automatic pistol from his pocket. Aiming at the officers, he said, 'Get your ugly faces out of here or I'll blow your heads off.'"
Classic.
Yeah. All of, I imagine it with more swearing, but they probably had to edit it for publication.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, he's Mormon.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. All of the lawmen left the area and immediately filed felony charges for criminal assault. Now, after this confrontation, Singer essentially converted his home into a compound and was like putting up wire covering to keep out tear gas canisters if they decided to throw tear gas in. They never left the house unarmed. After surveilling the Singers for 18 days, police attempted to arrest John Singer again as he checked his mailbox. He again pulled his pistol on the approaching agents who shot John multiple times, killing him. John's first wife, Vicky, was held overnight and then released back to their children. She was allowed to keep all the kids. And John's second wife, Shirley, she was not arrested, but the custody of her children were given back to their biological father. Vicky would later file a $110 million lawsuit against the state that would eventually be thrown out. And if you're wondering why Vicky's the one doing that, it's because she's legally married to John, and
gotcha.
I'm pretty sure they only recognize singular marriage in the United States, like everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, that is just the beginning. That's the first standoff, okay?
Oh, yay.
Now, enter a man named Adam Swap. At the time of this whole like standoff thing, he was in high school when John Singer died, and Swap had said that the shooting had a great impact on him. Now, he would eventually marry 2 of John's daughters, because, again, polygamy.
But also, that's like marrying sisters.
Yeah. I wonder if that's a normal thing or not. Like, I wonder if that's in relationships that practice polygamy, if that's like frowned upon, or if that's like a like an average, like, I married 3 sisters in the same family type of thing.
I mean, my great 2 of my great aunts married brothers. But that was not polygamy based.
I was gonna say, but one is not married to both brothers.
That was just being Southern.
That'd be like, yeah, that's true. That'd be like getting married to twins.
Yeah.
Like, or triplets. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Strange.
I guess
times.
if you have a type, like
have all of the type.
So he married 2 of John's daughters and then became part of the Singer family. Now, this is from Desert News. Quote, "It was during this time that Swap admitted he developed very, very strong religious beliefs and thought that somehow Singer was guiding him," end quote. "Then Swap said he had received a divine revelation that he could resurrect John Singer by bombing a public Latter-day Saints building." On the 9th anniversary of John Singer's death, SWAP planted 18 sticks of dynamite at the LDS meeting house, causing $1 to $1.5 million in damages. So this launched yet another standoff at the Singer property, this time lasting 13 days and involving approximately 150 officers, 14 members of his extended family, including John Singer's son, John Timothy, were holed up in the house, still thinking that this conflict would end with John being resurrected.
Of course.
I know. Which is just one of these things that it's like, I have to... It's weird because the idea is I have to incite this conflict in order for this resurrection to be complete. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that is some like psychological connection with the conflict that resulted in John's death before, or if that's just like some craziness, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Multiple negotiators were sent into the home, including Vicky's son-in-law, Roger Bates, who returned to authorities saying the family had absolutely no intention of surrendering. And a friend of the family, Ogden Kraut, who also reported a refusal to cooperate. SWAP was insisting that the conflict needed to play out for the resurrection to be successful. So authorities blasted the compound with loud noises and bright lights, which are both techniques that would later be used at Waco. Mm-hmm. Still pretty controversial because I'm pretty sure that's considered torture.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And on the final day of the standoff, John Timothy, who, by the way, was wheelchair bound, it wasn't totally clear why, but he was in a wheelchair at the time. John Timothy began shooting a rifle at officers as they prepared to release dogs on the property. So there was this, the plan was, as one of them was coming outside, they would blast them with strobe lights to, like, not disarm, but like stun them, right? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. As they're stunned by strobe lights, the officer would release the dog, which would then go and attack. So there's an accidental trigger of the strobe lights, and Lieutenant Fred House thought that it was actually a successful deal, and so he stood up into the open to release the dogs, and they started firing on him. So a total of 10 rounds were fired, one of which struck Lieutenant Fred House, who died as a result. SWAP was also injured in the ensuing shootout, eventually surrendering by waving a bloody white towel in the air. In 1988, John Timothy was convicted of murdering a police officer, receiving 10 years in prison and 5 years probation. He was released from prison in 2006. Adam Swap, who received the majority of the blame for the events that transpired and takes the majority. He's basically like, I set these things in motion. Yes, I realize that John Timothy killed this officer, but like he would not have been in that place had I not set all of these events in motion. So he takes most of the blame for this whole deal. He received 17 years for the church bombing and an additional 15 years for manslaughter. Before the sentencing, Swap voiced his belief that he probably wouldn't serve any prison time because the government was about to collapse if people didn't repent.
Totally.
Which, the instant somebody says something like that, like, I won't serve any of this because the government's just going to collapse.
If only it were that easy. Like,
yeah, yeah. But he did serve, so... Just about, yeah. His original sentencing came up for review in 2007, but they denied and he remained in prison. But in July 2013, Swap was released after serving 25 years in prison. He has since done interviews claiming to have a newfound faith in the Bible and issuing a formal apology for all of the actions that transpired. I'm always a little skeptical of people who do something horrible like this and... then is like, I found Jesus, but I'm skeptical of religion anyway. So I don't know that says much, you know. But yeah, that is the story of the Singer Swap standoff that I found in this little corner article of a newspaper from, what did I say? 1988 in my basement was this huge story of, yes, yeah.
Yes.
twists and turns. And honestly, I'm kind of surprised that I haven't heard of this, because mm-hmm. when you talk about things like Ruby Ridge and Waco, a lot of people point to other similar instances
right.
that came before. Mm-hmm. And I honestly cannot ever remember hearing of the Singer Swap standoff. So
yeah, I have not heard of that either, but no, it was the 80s. So everything gets hyped more. It was the 80s.
There's a lot of this type of shit going on. Yeah, true, true.
Well, I would say that was lighthearted in comparison to what's coming.
Yeah, I know. That was not even that lighthearted, but you're right.
So, Vicky, have you ever heard of the 1973 Wounded Knee Occupation?
I have.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Most people have not.
Yeah. And honestly, I believe it was something that we were taught in school, which...
I don't know.
I want to say like high school, probably. I don't think it was like the younger years, but I definitely mm-hmm. think it was at least touched on in high school.
Yeah, I don't recall that, but I also didn't pay attention much to history class because white people be tripping.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I've discussed AIM before in a past episode, and if you're not familiar or haven't heard that particular episode, it stands for the American Indian Movement, and they are the major players in the story that I will tell today of the 1973 Wounded Knee Occupation. Now, are you familiar with the original Wounded Knee, or the location of Wounded Knee?
Probably not.
Okay, so Wounded Knee Creek is a space in North Dakota along a river tributary. This land was declared in a treaty to belong to the Ogallala Lakota Sioux. It is what is referred to now as Pine Ridge Reservation area. The original Wounded Knee Massacre was in 1890, and this is what kicked off a whole host of events and inevitably what really was another trigger for the American Indian Movement being created. Now, throughout 1890, the U.S. government worried about increasing influences of Pine Ridge, particularly their ghost dance spiritual movement. Now, this movement taught that Indians had been confined to reservations because they had angered the gods by abandoning their traditional customs, because they were forced to. Many Sioux believed that if they practiced the ghost dance and rejected the ways of the white man, the gods would create the world anew and destroy non-believers, aka non-Indians, aka all them white people.
So is this like, do you feel like this is in direct response to everybody being forced on reservations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This was right around when residential schools were being kicked off. This was right around when they started the food subsidiary, where they started mass killing herds of buffalo, telling indigenous people that they weren't allowed to farm almost all of the lands that they were forced to reside on So, and then they started providing them with food that was like white flour, lard, and canned vegetables, which, if you know anything about indigenous foodways, they don't do that. They don't eat wheat. The lard that they eat is to cook in, and it's like, you know, bison tallow. On December 15th, 1890, reservation police tried to arrest Sitting Bull, who was the famous Sioux chief, who they mistakenly believed was a ghost dancer. He was not. And they killed him. And so, increasing the tensions at Pine Ridge, people started to kind of push back and try to force the reservation police off the reservation. And then a brutal massacre followed. It was estimated that 150 indigenous people were killed. Some historians place the number twice as high as that. Nearly half of them were women and children. In comparison, the cavalry who came in and massacred all the people, only 25 people in that cavalry died. So,
wow.
I'm going to say that the way that people report numbers, there's probably way more than 150 people.
Especially at that time, too. Oh, it was not... even close to accurate.
Mm-hmm. So this is the climax of the government controlling tribes and seizing lands, especially across the plains. They were committing genocide. If you don't believe that, you can stop listening now because it was genocide.
Yep.
So basically, 1860 to 1890 saw the extreme rapid movement of indigenous peoples to reservations and residential schools, which are concentration camps. We've talked about that.
Yeah.
Now I want to show you a very short clip because this kind of shows you how quickly the government moved people from their land and forced them into reservations. And it's a really great map, and it has a really great clip that you can watch. So let me cue it up here. So if you're not familiar, Sean Sherman is a indigenous chef. He is Sioux. He goes, his company's called the Sioux Chef, which is like a fun play on words.
That's Sioux cute. Chef, I like that.
He's Sioux.
Yeah, I like that.
But there's a massive movement right now to bring back indigenous foodways. I have his cookbook. It's beautiful. I've made some of the recipes. It's a lot of foraging, a lot of hunting. So if you want to check it out, it's really great. He has a food co-op. He has a YouTube channel. He does a lot of catering for events to show how to bring back foodways and finding all of these lost, you know, seeds and stuff and ways of cooking. So he talks about colonization in his work because obviously that is part of why their food waste changed. So this is, I'll cue this up here.
But then we look at U.S. colonialism, which is something very recent and people don't understand. So at the beginning of our country, in the late 1700s, still over 80% of the entire part of the land was still under indigenous control at that point in time. So Native American history isn't something that's ancient history, right? It's very recent. So again, this is just the era of my great-grandfather. So you'll see how fast that the U.S. government starts to push to take over indigenous people's lands. And it happens really fast, and especially after Civil War. So basically between the years of 1840 and 1870, almost all of the land is taken over. And during that time, the same thing is happening. People are being dislocated. They're getting pushed around. People are getting pushed into Oklahoma. Entire families are getting wiped out. All of these farming communities, seeds are disappearing from these, and all this farming that's happening on the eastern side of the United States. And it happens really, really fast. So for me, it was just kind of an eye-opener to think about like how recent this is and how little people don't understand our own histories, right? Because, I mean, if all you read about in history is from your high school textbooks, you're going to have a very skewed sense of American history since, you know, it was written by the U.S. government. So at the end of the 1800s, we have very little of any control of our lands left. So we lost a lot of things during that time period. So we're kind of in the sense of kind of traumatic healing at this point. We're barely getting to the point of healing. We just went through a very traumatic time period and a very recent time period too. So for us, like...
So it starts off in the 1780s, that map, and then it gets to the 1800s and all of a sudden it goes from blue, which is mostly indigenous, to gray, meaning that they're completely gone. And then all of these little yellow spots start popping up. And those are the reservations.
And it's interesting to see literally like the size of the reservations compared to the area where indigenous people were is like, it's like 0.1% of like the space that they started with, which is just absurd to me.
Yeah. So this site and this massacre are not only important parts of the Sioux history. They are major parts of the fight that indigenous groups continue even today. The fight for sovereignty and preserving heritage and their way of life. So the 60s and the 70s were, you know, major points in time for all of this kind of reclamation and fighting for people's basic human fucking rights. So Pine Ridge was, and probably still is, I think, the poorest reservation in the United States. And this was a really big contributing factor as to why the occupation began in the first place. The elected chief, Richard Wilson, was said to have been taking bribes and from the government and not caring about his own people. So in turn, a movement began to impeach him. Wilson had a private militia at his hand, though. So he had this group of people, and they were basically protecting him and kind of going around and busting up other people as they tried to get him impeached. The other major thing that was kind of a big deal is that Wilson sold grazing rights on the tribal land to local white ranchers at an extremely low rate, which reduced the income of the tribe. So they had all of this beautiful land because they're in North Dakota, and all that you can really do out there is farm or ranch. So instead of, you know, holding this land for his own people, he started basically renting it out, and he did so at, like, poverty rates. And so there's not very many ways that reservations can make money, and one of them is renting out part of their land. So he was basically, you know, telling them that their land is worth nothing. So the other thing that happened, he's renting out all of this land. He also leased nearly 1/8 of the reservation's mineral-rich lands to a private company. So one part of the reservation's being used for grazing, one part is being leased to a private company to harvest.
So was the primary motivation behind this, like, to get money or to, like, garner favor or, like...
It was for him to get money. He was basically...
Money and power.
Yeah, he was basically accepting bribes for all of this stuff.
Okay.
From people. So he was getting rich, but his people were not.
Gotcha. Okay.
So there was a significant increase as well at this time in attacks on Lakota men off the reservation, which local police failed to intervene in. In 1973, the murder of 20-year-old Wesley Badheart Bull in a bar in Buffalo Gap led to a small standoff. And then on February 6th, 1973, AIM led about 200 supporters to meet at the courthouse in Custer, where they expected to discuss civil rights issues and wanted charges against the suspect raised to murder from second-degree manslaughter. They were met by riot police, who allowed only 5 people to enter the courthouse despite the fact that there was a fucking blizzard happening outside.
Oh my god.
The confrontation became violent, during which protesters burned down the Chamber of Commerce building, damaged the courthouse, and destroyed 2 police cars and vandalized other buildings.
Holy shit.
Shortly after the impeachment proceedings against Wilson were brought, they really didn't go very far. He actually locked himself up in his home, and that's when the occupation started.
Okay.
The traditional chiefs and AIM leaders met with the community to discuss how to deal with the deteriorating situation on the reservation. Women elders such as OSCRO founder Ellen Moves Camp, Gladys Bissonnette, and Agnes Lamont urged the men to take action. On February 27, 1973, approximately 200 Ogallala Lakota and followers of the American Indian Movement occupied the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. The next day, AIM members traded gunfire with federal marshals surrounding the settlement and fired on automobiles, low-flying planes that they brought in, and anyone else who dared to come in within rifle range.
I mean, they were pretty much like, this is our space.
Yeah.
Stay out of it.
So immediately they set up roadblocks about in a 15-mile radius around the town. AIM demanded that the U.S. Senate launch an investigation into the Bureau of Indian Affairs, Pine Ridge, and the Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. They also wanted the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to hold hearings on all of the Indian treaties broken by the United States government. And I wanted to play this really quick clip from PBS because I feel like it is just exemplifies the feeling of what was happening during this time period. And it's just a minute clip, so it'll be pretty quick.
I was ready to do whatever it takes for change. I didn't care. I had children. And for them, I figured I could make a stand here.
They were up to no good. I mean, why would they be traveling in a caravan with all these weapons and all these Molotov cocktails if they weren't going to engage in some kind of destructive activity?
By the 1970s, native people, once masters of the continent, had become invisible, consigned to the margins of American life. Their anger and frustration would explode in Wounded Knee.
We were about to be obliterated culturally. Our spiritual way of life, our entire way of life was about to be stamped out. And this was a rebirth of our dignity and self-pride.
For the next 71 days, Indian protesters at Wounded Knee would hold off the federal government at gunpoint.
So you're hearing from people who were actually part of this occupation. And it shows this like beautiful line of like Sioux women in like their, you know, pants and denim shirts with fucking rifles and aviator sunglasses. It's just,
yeah,
it's the most epic, beautiful thing I could have ever hoped to see.
Yeah.
But then you hear from this asshole who was there as part of the U.S. Marshals. And he's like, oh, why are they driving around with guns and Molotov cocktails? First of all, they did not have Molotov cocktails. That's hearsay.
Right.
They did have a shit ton of rifles, though. And they, you know, they did burn down the buildings in Custer, but it wasn't Molotov cocktails. They, like, set, you know, trash cans on fire and stuff. So it's not the same. It's so frustrating.
I always love this idea of, like, the government doing some really shitty stuff, mm-hmm. and then people get mad, and then they're like, why is everybody so mad? Why is everybody doing all this? I'm like, come on, guys. Like, no... It's one of these things that I'm like, fucking really? Like, look around, yeah. Read the fucking room and
yes,
figure out why people are mad, okay? Yeah.
So, this occupation lit a fire in other indigenous groups to start another wave of civil rights fights. Now, we often talk about civil rights movements and the women's liberation movement, but we really fail, and perhaps this is purposefully so, to acknowledge the Native civil rights movement. The government in the 70s was almost successful in completely eradicating Native peoples. Like, completely eradicating them.
Yeah.
There were such low birth rates and such a high percentage of death in the 70s on reservations that I'm not even fucking kidding. We almost didn't have Indigenous people in the United States anymore. Through government food programs, forced poverty, straight up ignoring murders of people, and not providing assistance when people were asking and demanding that they needed help on reservations, they dwindled the population down to practically fucking nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, getting back to the occupation, there was an account by the U.S. Marshal Service that I am not going to read to you, because quite frankly, it's a joke. The way that they described individuals involved and the event in total is beyond shameful and absolutely disgusting. If you remember Ruby Ridge and Waco and how they were handled, it's a whole lot of that minus the outrage, because these people were not white. So there was outrage after Waco and Ruby Ridge, but there was no outrage after the massacre of all of these fucking people. So,
right. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking, like, it wasn't the same outrage because the people who got mad about fucking Ruby Ridge and Waco were, like, white either supremacist. Religious fundamentalists. Yeah, religious fundamentalists or fucking white supremacists. So, God.
So, there's a great newspaper quote, and it was kind of just describing what the United States government brought and what I told you that the indigenous peoples already had. So. The equipment maintained by the military while in use during the siege included 15 armored personnel carriers, clothing, rifles, grenade launchers, flares, and 133,000 rounds of ammunition for a total cost, including the use of maintenance personnel from the National Guard, of 5 states and a pilot in planes for aerial photography, cost over $500,000.
Oh my God.
So they had all this equipment, they spent $500,000, and all the people on the reservation had were fucking rifles.
It's so maddening. It's so maddening. Like, oh God. I mean, obviously, I think there is something to be said for hindsight. Like, we are looking back at this now in 2021 being like, that's fucking overkill.
But let me bring this up. What about Standing Rock? That's recent. Same fucking thing happened. They were bringing water cannons and rifles and a tank to people who were saying, we don't want our water contaminated. So nothing has changed.
Yeah. And that's not, I don't want to say that as an excuse to like, be like, this was fine. But I do think some people will be like, well, you guys are looking at this in hindsight. Obviously, we didn't know then what we know now. But I'm sorry. Like, we knew enough to not try to like kill a whole bunch of fucking people.
Yeah.
You know, like there's some common sense things in there that's like, just basic human decency that, oh God, it's just so, makes me mad. It makes me real mad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So after 30 days, in like typical government style, they cut off the water supply and food to the location. However, since the people who lived on the reservation knew the land the fucking best, they were able to smuggle in food, water, and medical aid just fine. So they tried, but they did not succeed in cutting off food and water. Now, there was one person in the conflict who was a U.S. Marshal who did get shot right when it started, and they did suffer paralysis and are in a wheelchair for the rest of their life. However, there are multiple people who were on the opposing side who were murdered. Frank Clearwater, who was a Cherokee supporter from North Carolina, snuck into the reservation to assist. He was shot in the head on April 17th, within 24 hours upon arrival. He was resting in an occupied church, and a sniper took him out. Lawrence Buddy Lamont, who was a local Ogallala, was killed by a government sniper as well on April 26th. He was buried on the site in a Sioux ceremony, and after his death, tribal elders called to end the occupation. It didn't happen right away, so...
Yeah.
One of the strangest things that I read about that occurred had to do with a gentleman called Ray Robinson. Now, Ray Robinson was a black civil rights activist who went to South Dakota to join the Wounded Knee occupation. He was seen there by a journalist and another activist, and somehow he disappeared during the siege and was never found.
Huh.
The widow of Robinson tried to get attention brought to his disappearance again when there was a conviction established on the murder of Anna Mae Aquash in 2004. We covered that in a previous episode, so you can go back to that one to hear more about that. They still don't know what happened to him. There was some rumblings that people thought that he might be an FBI informant.
Oh, really?
And there are a lot of people who think that he is dead and buried somewhere on the reservation. So the siege lasted a total of 71 days and ended on May 8th, 1973. Russell Means and Dennis Banks were arrested, which were the AIM founders, but on September 16th, 1973, the charges against them were dismissed by a federal judge because of the U.S. government's unlawful handling of witnesses and evidence.
Big shocker, yeah.
Unfortunately, the violence continued on Pirage after the occupation. I hate using the word siege in all of this because it makes it sound like what they were doing was unjustified, but it totally was justified. Mm-hmm. So just take that into consideration when you're reading stuff about this. You're going to find a lot of it coming up as siege instead of an occupation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Richard Wilson's devout followers attacked several people on the reservation who wanted to have him ousted, and more than 60 people who opposed the tribal government died violently shortly after the occupation. AIM claimed that many of these murders were not solved, of course. The FBI denies this, but if you see how many bodies have been uncovered during excavations of residential schools recently, honey, you know that there is more deaths that have not been investigated or reported.
So many. I bet you there is so many.
In 1975, two FBI agents and a Native American man were killed in a massive shootout between federal agents and AIM members and local residents in the same area. In a controversial trial, AIM member Leonard Pelletier was found guilty on first-degree murder and sentenced to two consecutive life terms, and then AIM disbanded shortly after this in 1978. So it went quickly downhill.
Mm-hmm.
But the fight still proceeds today. Like I mentioned, we've had Standing Rock, the residential school mass graves, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the acknowledgement finally by the Canadian government of the Trail of Tears up in Canada.
Right.
And then we have the land back movement that's happening right now. And this is all things that have happened in the past 10 to 15 years. So what AIM started in the late 60s still continues today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I wanted to end this little informational thing with a bit of a soapbox moment. Let me pull my soapbox out here.
All right. Get it, girl.
Here we go. If you would like to aid in the reclamation of land and community of Indigenous peoples in this country, I 1,000% urge you to visit landback.org, ndncollective.org, or honorearth.org. These sites give you ways to help fight for climate justice, racial equity, land stewardship, fucking basic water rights, and a whole lot more. In case you weren't aware, Indigenous people are the largest group of land stewards in the world. the United States committed genocide on indigenous peoples, and it's time to kind of recognize that and change the tides. I'm really proud to hear the announcement by the Secretary of Interior, Debbie Haaland, who is a Laguna Pueblo, that they're going to be investigating all of this in the residential schools. But, like, please, 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 please read history books that you did not read in school, because there's so much more information out there that you have no idea ever happened and that we were part of, that we did, that we committed as a country. I recommend the book An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. If you don't want to pick up a book, head over to the zinedproject.org. That's Z-I-N-N-E-D project.org. Also, you can look up some works by Debbie Reese. She also has a website. And I could really, like, list off 1,000 things. But if you're very curious and you want to know more, just email us at thebadtastecrimecast@gmail.com. It's part of my job. I can give you some recommendations. It's what I do all day. It's part of one of my many jobs.
It's true.
This is a major part of my art education research and part of my job working in the library. I work in youth services mostly, and we absolutely make it a point to represent and bring attention to ignored groups. I have specifically created book lists for people who wanted to have children's books from perspectives that are non-white, and helping students with research projects. And as part of my art education research, I've done a lot of research on art in residential schools and how it fucking saved a lot of those kids' lives. So if you have questions or want to know more or want to know some recommendations, just email us and I will send some stuff your way.
Great. That was very educational.
Yes.
I would say.
End with the education.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really interesting and important story. And I'm glad that you were able to tell it, because I think there's a lot of stuff in there that I didn't particularly know. Mm-hmm. So
it's hard. It's very hard yeah. to read a lot of the stuff without, like, bursting into tears.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very personal.
Yes. If you find yourself in a standoff for whatever reason,
put the gun down.
use your own tactics and blast this podcast out of a loudspeaker at police.
Some would have you believe that this is, quote, a promotional ad blurb for the Nihilist Podcast Network, done in the style of the popular NPN news show This Week in Nihilism. Subscribe to Nihilist Podcast Network on iTunes or another podcast app to hear more of This Week in Nihilism's up-to-the-week updates on world news and popular culture. That's all the time we have for this promotional ad blurb. Join us next ad blurb, assuming the Earth has not been destroyed by way too many ants. Nihilist
Podcast Network. Okay, well, that has been our episode. Yeah. Cool. If you want to hear more like this, you go to badtastepodcast.com, where we have this and all of our episodes. You can also find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher. Actually, if you're listening to this, you probably already found us, so that's fine.
Good on you.
Yeah. If you want some merch, there is a link to our merch page on our website. There's also a link to our donate page. If you want to support the show that way, you can. We won't say no. I think I said that on the last episode, and I was like, yes. It's true. We won't say no. What else? Do we have anything else, Janelle?
Yeah. Keep an eye out. We will be performing at the Fringe Festival, Elgin Fringe Festival.
How did I forget about the Fringe?
September. Like I said, they're still kind of figuring things out. Once, because I'm part of the library world and we do a lot of stuff with schools, once school starts, shit's probably going to hit the fan again, just so you guys know. We might have to roll backwards. There might have to be some more shots that we have to take. So the Fringe Festival might have to do some shifting. So we don't know currently if we'll be in person or recorded or on Zoom or whatever.
Yeah.
But that will kind of start to be put together more as we get closer to the date. So that's going to be in September. You can head over to Elgin Fringe Festival or Side Street Studio Arts if you want to find out more information or look at some of the old stuff from previous shows.
You said more shots, and I was like, shots of what?
Boosters. shots of tequila to get us through the winter.
But I was like, are we doing shots already? Okay. It's only 9 o'clock, but
tequila shots while we get our booster COVID shots.
Yes. Fuck yeah. I would do that. That'd be fun. So on that note, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fulman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, The Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We will see you in 2 weeks. Goodbye.
Bye.
...has murdered 10 young women and left their bodies on the hillsides along the highway.
It was as if a wave of evil washed over this town.
We are all evil in some form.